What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Dr. Joy Layden, the first openly transgender professor at an Orthodox Jewish institution, and a poet and an author. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I received an email last week from a Too Jewish listener, Floyd Angel, who asked a question I've heard many times before in one way or another, including from members of my own family. Why did Jews support President Barack Obama? This question is often asked by people who remember the passionate support that George W. Bush had for the Jewish state when he was president, and see President Obama's policies and statements as being far less automatically supportive of Israel. I'll talk about Obama's specific choices on policies and public statements next week, but there's a broader question implied, and it is the same question political strategists of both political parties in America have been asking for a long time. It is actually a question that has huge political implications. The question is, why do most Jews live like upper-middle-class whites, or better, but vote like inner-city blacks? This is not an anti-Semitic or racist question. It's a sociological or psychological one. Most immigrant groups start out as we Jews did, poor and scrambling. When they embrace citizenship and voting, they tend to vote their economic interests, supporting whichever party appeals to the impoverished new immigrants best. For the better part of the past century, that party has generally been the Democratic Party, with some interlopers along the way, the Socialist Party, for example. Virtually since its founding, in the pre-Civil War period, the Republican Party has been the party of business, both little and big, and that has mostly led it away from immigrant Americans, who typically feel that their interests are best served by those who represent labor, including labor unions. Certainly, since the time of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, immigrant groups in their first and even second generations have tended to vote Democratic, at least in national elections, and to support Democratic candidates. Over time, sometimes in one generation, sometimes in several, the American dream works its wonders. Poor immigrants become settled citizens and often highly successful, well-integrated, upwardly mobile voters. These descendants of immigrants tend to change their voting patterns as they move to nicer and nicer neighborhoods and away from the cities to the suburbs and the exurbs. They also usually change their votes. The more accepted they feel as Americans, the wealthier they become, the more educated their kids are, the more assimilated and farther from immigrant roots they go, the more likely they typically are to vote for the political party that better represents their interests. That is, the interests of people of more means, with more assets and more to lose. Since the Republican Party typically represents the party that seeks to cut taxes and often seems to favor policies that help more established folks over those just starting out, these people tend to vote Republican. While this is an oversimplification and a bit of a stereotype, it's also fairly accurate. First-generation immigrants tend to vote Democratic, as do their kids. By the third generation, they are often living in leafy subdivisions and gated communities, joining country clubs, and voting Republican. So, following this great American pattern blazed by many immigrant groups before us and after us, we Jews should now be voting 70-80% Republican. Although we've been in what is now the United States since the 17th century, most American Jews are descended in whole or part from the great wave of Ashkenazic Jewish immigration that took place from 1880 to 1924 or so. To telescope it a little, our parents or grandparents or great-grandparents came over from Russia or Poland or somewhere in the old country of Eastern and Central Europe and settled on the Lower East Side of New York, worked very hard, moved out to Brooklyn or the Bronx, then, after World War II, on to Long Island or Westchester or New Jersey, or really anywhere around the country. And now we live in generally lovely suburbs and fancy neighborhoods. Lower taxes personally benefit us, as do laws and regulations that favor investments and other pro-business policies. While Bubby and Zadie may have been socialists and voted for Eugene Debs, and your parents signed peace petitions after World War II, and you came of age during the peace protests of the 60s or 70s, you are no long-haired hippie anymore. Your interests are those of the upper and upper middle class, which means lower taxes and more freedom to make money on investments and to pass on your estate eventually to your kids and grandchildren. So if you're a Jew in your 40s or 50s or 60s or 70s or even 80s, why wouldn't you vote for the party that cuts taxes and lowers estate duties and lets you do personally better on your investments, the party that business almost always supports to a much greater degree, that is, the Republican Party? Bottom line, if we Jews are like other Americans, why the heck don't we now vote for the GOP? And if you don't think Republican Party strategists have been killing themselves for 40 years and more trying to get that to change, you don't know much about American politics. This oddity always surprises people, and it has for a very long time. I remember in the 1970s when I was a student at Ralph Waldo Emerson Junior High School in West Los Angeles, having a social studies teacher giving us the voting patterns of various ethnic groups in America. He listed African Americans, which we then called blacks, as voting 90% plus Democratic. Latinos substantially voting Democratic, Italians having started as Democrats and then about evenly split between Democrats and Republicans, and so on. When it came to religious voting by affiliation, he noted that Episcopalians at the time voted Republican 70-75% of the time, Catholics 50-50 or so, Southern Baptists used to be all Southern Democrats but were swinging Republican, and so on. Finally, about Jews, he said, Jews vote 80% Republican. And vocal as always, I raised my hand and said, I think that's wrong. I personally, at that time, did not know a single Jew who had voted Republican besides my grandmother, who was German-Jewish and therefore didn't really count. Anyway, the teacher challenged me to back up my claims that Jews voted Democratic. And I did research and found out that, in fact, Jews voted and affiliated about 70-80% Democratic. Now, this was back in 1973. Since then, as an ethnic group, Jews have only done better and better economically and socially in America, become more and more assimilated and accepted. So why wouldn't we change and vote Republican? Why do we continue to vote against our own economic interests and to do so consistently and convincingly in nearly every national election? The lowest percentage of the Jewish vote taken by any Democratic presidential candidate in the past 20 years was Obama's 69% last year. 69% was not exactly a massive defection to the Republican candidate, Mitt Romney. Why doesn't this paradoxical voting pattern, and the political support it represents, change even when the president involved seems less supportive of Israel, which is such a critical issue for so many Jews? The answer in some ways is complicated, in other ways pretty clear and consistent. It's that we Jews started as outsiders, both ethnically and religiously, that we never really dropped that perspective even when we became insiders. We always, always have a nearly inbred understanding of what it means to be a new immigrant, to come to a place with nothing and struggle painfully to make ends meet, to feel the sting of oppression and exile. Even those of us who grew up in much greater comfort, not me personally, but many of us, know that when push comes to shove, the people in power often attack us, and that the establishment is very, very rarely our friends. Even the industries we've created, the movie business, comic books, large parts of the high-tech world from Steve Wozniak to Sergey Brin to Mark Zuckerberg, are kind of outsider-oriented, edgy, uncomfortable with the status quo, you know, basically neurotic. That means that it's almost preternaturally difficult for Jews to trust that the party that represents the old elite, that stands for waspy businesses and establishment institutions, is ever going to be truly trustworthy for us. There's an outsider mentality that lives deep inside the Jewish psyche. It helps us think of new and better ways to do things, and it forces us to look at the world through eyes other than our own, especially including those who have less than we have and may need our help. And our long history also means that it's extremely hard for us to support any political party that bashes immigrants. Blame it on Passover and the annual Seders that remind the 80% of Jews who make this holiday the most observed Jewish experience in America that our own ancestors were wandering Aramean immigrants, later slaves in Egypt, and then again, wandering Jews throughout most of our very long history. You know, immigrants. We do care a lot about Israel, almost all of us, and that's why Jimmy Carter didn't get much help when he ran for re-election in 1980 and only polled 45% of the Jewish vote. He was widely perceived as pro-Palestinian and anti-Israel, and he has done nothing to dissuade us of that view in his retirement. But no Democratic presidential candidate since Carter has garnered less than 64%, even running against wildly pro-Israel candidates like Ronald Reagan and Bush the Younger and John McCain. Maybe this will finally change in the next national election cycle. Maybe President Obama will swing the U.S. position so far to the Palestinians that Jews will abandon the Democratic Party once and for all and follow their economic interests. But I don't think so. Oddly, it's the Jews who most stand out in America, the ones who are the least assimilated, who have now become reliably Republican. For Orthodox Jews, the issue of Israel is even more important than for the rest of us, and while both parties are very strongly pro-Israel now, the Republican Party tends to favor the Israeli right wing, as do American Orthodox Jews, while the Democratic Party's pro-Israel favoritism tends to lean center and left, as Reform and many conservative Jews also do. Also, in many ways, the values of the Orthodox community, both ultra-Orthodox and modern Orthodox, reflect concerns about social issues that follow Republican Party orthodoxy. Orthodox Jews often oppose gay and lesbian rights, tend to oppose liberal laws on abortion, prefer to see the government support parochial schools and institutions. They like the public display of religion generally, like seeing the Ten Commandments in courthouses. We liberal Jews aren't in sync with our Orthodox cousins on many of these issues, just as we aren't in sync with the Republican Party on them. Next week, we'll explore the current relationship between Barack Obama and Israel and the whole complicated melange of the Middle East from an American Jewish perspective. But the heart of the matter, the ikar, as we say in Hebrew, is that so long as the Democratic Party and its leader, the president, seem to have a stronger identification with the outsider and the downtrodden and the immigrant, as long as they seem basically pro-Israel, if not totally so, they are still going to have the support of most non-Orthodox American Jews. When the Republican Party changes that perception and is seen as the party of the outsider or the immigrant, then it will begin to win over more Jewish support. Until that time, frankly, it simply won't. To play us in on this hot summer morning, happy official summer, by the way, as of last week, here's a cut from the Tzofim Friendship Caravan, a group of Israeli teens entering 12th grade who tour the world, and especially America, promoting Israel. They were here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, singing at my own Temple Emmanuel last Sunday night and at the J. It's the Mizrahi Standard Halavai. May it only be. Please. That was the great Israeli song, Halavai, sung by the Tzofim Friendship Caravan Teens from Israel. You know, it's a wonderful group, kind of a cross between Up With People meets Disney's version of the Junior IDF. Anyway, good song. When we come back on Too Jewish This Morning, we'll meet Dr. Joy Layden, the first openly transgender professor at an Orthodox Jewish institution of higher learning, Yeshiva University, no less, and hear her fascinating story when we come back on Too Jewish.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Craig difference at Jim Craig Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all new body style. It looks absolutely great. It's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a vent price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Craig difference.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted and welcome to Too Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor Joy Layden. She's the author of the book, Through the Door of Life, A Jewish Journey Between Genders. She is the David and Ruth Gottesman Professor of English at Stern College for Women of Yeshiva University. And I would somehow suspect probably the first openly transgender professor, let alone employee, maybe person at Yeshiva University and maybe at any Orthodox institution. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, how does it feel to hear, you must hear this a lot, you know, you're the first person to do this, to be in an Orthodox setting. What does that feel like?
Well, it makes me feel much more important than English professors usually get to feel. I get to feel like I'm making a contribution to Tikkun Olam just by showing up for work and having students show up for my classes. And I know that to Orthodox Jews who are trans or lesbian or gay or bisexual or otherwise wondering if they'll ever find a place in their worlds and in their communities, they now look to Yeshiva University and the fact that I'm there as a sign of hope on the horizon.
For those of our listeners who don't know, Yeshiva University is sort of the paramount modern Orthodox institution. You know, it's extremely well regarded academically in the Orthodox world. Even for the people that don't consider themselves modern Orthodox, in the Orthodox world, they respect Yeshiva University. So this must have been shocking to the Yeshiva University mm-hmm. community. How was it received, and do people mm-hmm. understand?
Those are great questions. So this is a long process. I think for every organization and community and really relationship, when you have somebody who transitions from living as one gender to living as another, it takes a long time. It's not, you know, the initial reactions, and it's really a process of years of renegotiating relationships because gender is such a fundamental part of the way we know one another. So, like almost every institution dealing with its first trans employee, mine wanted me to go away at first. So, I had just received tenure, and New York City is a place that has...
That was probably a good thing that you'd already received tenure?
Well, I waited. Uh-huh. It was very difficult. That last semester, continuing to live as a man was pretty painful at that point, and I wasn't sure I would make it through classes without passing out. It was kind of came just in time.
Sure.
And New York City has a human rights law that covers gender identity and expression, which is not that common in the United States. So I had as much legal protection as anyone can have. And the university's response was to say, you know, full salary, full benefits, full everything, but you can't set foot on campus. It's the policy of the university that no physically male person may set foot on campus dressed as a woman. And I think this policy was made up for my benefit.
I'm sure.
But the truth is that most organizations don't really know what to do with their first trans employee. And so my attorneys, Lambda Legal, said, yeah, that's pretty standard. Go take the money, right? They're paying you, so take the money, and we'll wait and see what happens. What happened is that, thanks to the internet, my students started to find out what was going on, and I started getting emails from students who really had never heard of trans anything before, but they were furious that their professor was being treated this way, and they were specifically upset that an institution that represented Orthodox Judaism would treat a human being disrespectfully, as they saw it. They felt that this was really a chilul Hashem, you know, a desecration of God's name. And one of them, who is probably the most politically conservative person I've ever been in the same room with, her email started, "As you know, I'm very politically conservative. However, I'm outraged by this, and I'm going to go talk to the dean." And my immediate response was, "My poor dean," because I knew this student. And she didn't just go back once. She kept going back.
Right.
So I asked a couple of times to come back and teach, and I was told very politely, you know, "We love you, you think you're great, but you can never teach here because students and parents will never accept you."
Right.
And then in the spring, when my attorney sent a demand letter, and I was trying to reconcile myself to, you know, living on a seven-figure settlement of some sort or another.
Not so terrible.
Not so terrible. They stunned us by writing back and saying, "Of course you can come back and teach."
Well, let's talk about how that came about when we come back in a few moments with Dr. Joy Layden on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio, or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows by streaming them from our website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So in not very long, you go all the way back to Israel. Let's talk a little bit about what you think the future holds after 3 years in the United States, 3 years working here, but coming from an Israeli perspective. What do you think the future holds for Judaism in America?
You know, that's a very big question. Before coming here, like many Israelis, I tend to think that our role as Israelis is to come and save the American Jewish community from assimilation or, you know, whatever.
Conversion or disappearance or something.
Right.
Materialism.
And I definitely think that's a big challenge for the American Jewish community. But I think reality is more complicated than people in Israel see it when you look at the American Jewish community. Definitely the questions of what is Jewish, What are the boundaries of being Jewish? Who is a member of the tribe? What is this glue that keeps us together? Is something that will be very significant. I think a very significant question. I think the shift of American Jewry into a more individualistic approach, a more consumer type of approach, raises a lot of challenges about Jewish identity. And those challenges come from the edges, not from the mainstream. They come from the things that we don't normally see. Like, for example, Messianic groups that self-define or self-identify as Jews and at the same time believe in Jesus, for example. Or from another side, Jewish groups that have elements of Buddhism engage into Jewishness. Or secular groups or humanistic groups or so on, that kind of stretches the boundaries of what American Jews define as Jewish and what Israelis define as Jewish, and where do we meet each other. I think also the competition in such a consumer world is very challenging, because nowadays the kids don't get nearly any Jewish education. You fight over their time against basketball, against baseball, swimming, or any other thing.
And cell phone video games.
Exactly. So being Jewish or learning about Jewish life is in competition on the same time slots as things that are much more fun and attractive and maybe help you get to a better college. And Hebrew school finds itself in a very challenging spot on that competition. Not sure that it has the, you know, what it takes to win the competition. So I think those are major questions, and the role of Israel in that place, the role of Hebrew in that place, is a very interesting question and maybe an interesting opportunity. You know, it could be that Israel will become a central element in building the future Jewish identity of American Jews, maybe trips to Israel, years abroad in Israel. And on the other hand, it could be that American Jews would become a significant players in the creation of a new Jewish identity in Israel that will be more pluralistic, more open to other threads and colors and tastes of Judaism, and not just the Orthodox on one hand and secular Zionistic approach on the other.
It's a great question, and it'll be an ongoing question, and we'll keep exploring it for a couple more weeks. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
The Syrian civil war seems only to get worse, and the problems that seem to be cropping up for Israel may be even more serious. Russia now may be sending anti-aircraft systems to Syria, Israel threatening to blow those up if they get to Syria. Pretty serious mess.
Right. Of course, the Russian government has made a big point of saying, we haven't delivered those yet.
Right.
We're delaying, and I think they're trying to stay, I don't know if they care that much about being in Israel's good graces, but they do care about being in our good graces. However, the situation in Syria obviously is very closely related to the situation in Turkey, and one would have thought that if there were an uprising or a protest movement in Turkey, it might be related to the Syrian civil war and the overflow. I mean, there's been cross-border attacks. There's floods of refugees. All of southeastern Turkey is, if not in turmoil, that would be an exaggeration, but certainly on the alert and worried about the situation in Syria. There is one province of Turkey, which arguably was sort of stolen away from Syria, called the Hatay province. And that's one of the places where these protests have been most acute. So there's clearly a relationship of one sort or another between what goes on in Turkey and what goes on in Syria. But Syria is sort of pivotal for the whole region. It plays a role in Lebanon, obviously. It's important for Israel because it's a bordering state, and there's the whole question of the Golan Heights. Syria
heavily is involved with Hezbollah,
right,
which is Israel's great sort of terrorist enemy at the moment.
Right. And to the extent to which a rump Syrian state or whatever's left of Syria is really dependent on Iran, that will be a subject of great concern for Israel, because Iran is sort of enemy number one in the region right now in the perception of most Israeli strategic thinkers and political scientists. Now, that changes from year to year, but right now...
been a while, though, that's been Iran.
Yeah, and nobody knows what's going to happen in Syria, in part because the European Union is in disorder, sort of preoccupied with its own problems. The U.S. doesn't really have a clear policy regarding Syria. And it looks like the civil war...
It's being debated in Time magazine between a former secretary of... two former secretaries of state. Clearly, the United States doesn't have a set policy.
Right. Well, and even the president has contradicted himself as to what our policy is or should be or might become. And so, you know, this civil war could extend indefinitely, and it looks fairly evenly balanced unless something decisive happens, that either Russia steps in decisively on the side of the government or the U.S. steps in decisively on the side of the rebels or whatever. And, I mean, the other question that hangs over all this is, who knows, who are the rebels? What do they want? What's their agenda? Are they unified? Are there multiple groups? Are there competing groups? I mean, that nobody really talks about because it's a bit of a can of worms.
Yeah, it's a mess. I mean, it ranges from radical Islamists to and people allied with Al-Qaeda to basically what we would think of as pro-Western Democrats, the people who simply want an electoral system that isn't, you know, Assad the dictator. We will talk next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Moshe is sitting at the bar, staring into his drink, when a large, troublemaking biker comes up next to him, grabs his drink, and gulps it down in one swallow, then menacingly says, "Thanks, Jew boy. What you gonna do about it?" And Moshe bursts into tears. "Come on, man," the biker says. "I didn't think you'd cry. Can't stand to see a grown man cry. What's your problem?" "This is the worst day of my life," Moshe says. "I'm a complete failure. I was late to a meeting and my boss fired me. I went to the parking lot, my car was stolen, and I don't have any insurance. I left my wallet in the cab that I took home and found my wife in bed with a male guy. And then my dog bit me. Finally, I just came to this bar to work up the courage to put an end to it all. I buy a drink, I drop in the cyanide and sit there watching the poison dissolve. And you show up and drink the whole thing down. But enough about me. How's your day going?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read a portion from the middle of the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. It's named after a guy, Pinchas, whose story we began at the end of last week's portion of Balak. The situation's familiar. For the umpteenth time, the people of Israel have been disobeying the Torah and worshiping other gods. This time, the apostasy has reached epidemic proportions, and even the elite leadership of the people has begun to sample the religious wares of the Midianites and Moabites. Finally, one of the princes of the people challenges the authority of Moses publicly. He takes a sacred prostitute into his tent while the whole assembly watches. As Moses and the other elders stand by in shock, unable to respond to such a chutzpahdik act, a young Kohen, a priest named Pinchas, steps forward. He kills the wayward prince and his consort and breaks the spell of false religious practice. For this act, he is rewarded by God, which seems to validate his violent vigilantism. But there's more to the story than meets the eye, for Pinchas' reward for killing the couple from God is a Brit Shalom, a covenant of peace. Neither Pinchas nor any of his descendants is ever again to be permitted to go to war or even to carry a spear. He must minister to the needs of the tabernacle, the rituals of the altar, those of purification and sacrifice, and he can never again engage in acts of violence. He has broken the Israelites' latest fascination with paganism, but never again will his level of religious violence be tolerated. It must instead be sublimated to serve the needs of the community. An ongoing lesson about the dangers of religious fanaticism. Judaism refuses to countenance the kind of religious insanity that led to the Crusades, or Jihad, or the Inquisition, or religious terrorism. In spite of the occasional anomaly, our religious fervor is designed never to lead to passionate violence. We are committed, fervently and firmly, to the same Brit Shalom, the covenant of peace that God places on Pinchas. So may it always be. When we come back on Too Jewish, our fascinating guest, Dr. Joy Layden, will explain how she chose to complete the process of becoming a woman from her biological condition of being a man, and remained a professor at Yeshiva University after all. It's a remarkable tale from an extraordinary guest. Hear it when we come back on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israeli President Shimon Peres's 90th birthday celebrations took place in Israel last week. The Israeli presidential conference began at the Peres Academic Center in Rehovot when former U.S. President Bill Clinton gave an upbeat 45-minute address on the urgency of creating a two-state solution to put a halt to tensions between the Israeli and Palestinian peoples. Clinton talked about how the Palestinian birth rate is so much higher than the Israeli birth rate, and that in order for Israel to remain democratic, it must embrace the fact that creating a state of Palestine is the only solution. The former president also called Peres one of the world's greatest visionaries before his heartfelt tribute to late Israeli President Yitzhak Rabin, Allah Vashalom, calling Rabin's assassination the worst thing that happened in his entire term as president of the U.S. Clinton ended his speech with his famous phrase, Shalom Chaver. In a move that made the controversy surrounding his speaking fee obsolete, Clinton donated the $500,000 that was given to the Clinton Foundation as his speaking fee right back to the Peres Academic Center as a scholarship fund for the institution's students. The JNF was originally supposed to sponsor Bill Clinton's talk and his fee, but withdrew amid growing public pressure that the money could find a better use. Very classy gesture from Bill Clinton. Shimon Peres's 90th birthday celebration included a gala celebration in Jerusalem with over 3,000 guests, including Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, Barbara Streisand, Robert De Niro, Sharon Stone, and many others. In other news from Israel, there's an election coming up, and it's not one you would think. It's for the position of chief Ashkenazic rabbi, and while this has typically been a very quiet sort of election, this particular one is getting a lot more attention than the usual change of leadership in that post. The chief rabbi is head of the Rabbanut, the institution that establishes rules for all personal status in Israel, weddings, funerals, divorces, conversions, as well as choosing the rabbis for each official religious court in the country. While the Israeli government is secular and the country is run by the rule of Israeli law, not halakha, Jewish law, certain areas are kind of handed off to the Rabbanut by the state. These include not only life cycle events and issues, but the whole state apparatus of religious instruction. Israeli schools are either secular or religious, one track or the other, and the Rabbanut has a great deal to say about what direction the religious track schools go. This means that the position of chief rabbi in Israel has very important influence on the daily life of many Israeli citizens, as well as a significant symbolic role. Well, last week, the largest umbrella organization of modern Orthodox rabbis in America, the Rabbinical Council of America, gave its support to Rabbi David Stav, the reformist candidate in the upcoming Israeli chief rabbinate election, in the face of recent attacks. Rabbi Stav, the head of the liberal rabbinic association Tzohar, has pledged to revamp the ultra-Orthodox-dominated institution, making it more inclusive and responsive to Israel's diverse Jewish citizens. The letter, signed by the RCA leadership, reads, "We wish to convey our deep sense of appreciation for all that you have done for the betterment of the people of Israel, the land of Israel, and the state of Israel. We look forward to working together with you for many years to expand and glorify the Torah and to bring hearts closer to our Father in heaven." That said, adds Rabbi Shmuel Golden, president of the RCA and a past guest of Two Jewish, the letter was not meant as an endorsement of Rabbi Stav. The RCA has been very careful in not taking an official position on the election of chief rabbi. We support the position itself, as opposed to a particular candidate, and so forth. While Rabbi Stav is tremendously popular among Israel's secular Jewish population and has received the backing of four of the five parties in the country's governing coalition, he's also made many enemies with his pointed critiques of the entrenched religious establishment's corruption and bureaucracy. The RCA's letter comes as Rabbi Stav has been under increasing attack, both verbal and physical, from ultra-Orthodox elements in Israel who want to preserve the status quo. This week, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, the former Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel and a spiritual leader of the religious party Shas, denounced Stav as an evil man and a danger to Judaism. These are scary words. The aspiring chief rabbi was physically attacked at a wedding after those words, Rabbi Stav was, as well as being verbally assaulted when he departed. Notably, the RCA explicitly condemned Yosef's incendiary rhetoric in its letter of support to Stav, a rare move in the Orthodox world, given Rabbi Yosef's widely respected scholarship, although he has certainly said many crackpot things in his time. In political support, Yisrael Beiteinu chairman Avigdor Lieberman also forcefully condemned the attacks on Stav. "We wish Rabbi Stav all the success in the world. We pray that this inflammatory rhetoric, and particularly its physical expression, end." And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our extraordinary guest, Professor Joy Layden, whose book is called Through the Door of Life, A Jewish Journey Between Genders, and it chronicles her journey just exactly as it sounds, from male to female, as a professor at Yeshiva University teaching English. Joy, we spoke at the beginning of the show about Yeshiva University's initial response, knowing that legally they didn't have a lot of choice. They gave you full benefits, full salary, but told you don't come back. Don't teach here, we love you, you're a good teacher, but you can't be here, we have policies against it, and so on. And then they flipped, they changed their minds, perhaps because of the student response. Was there another rationale?
I was never told why. In fact, the letter said, and this is the official position of the university, that this was a misunderstanding. That of course they had planned for me to come back, and they were not sure why I and my attorneys had ever thought otherwise. And I was going through a divorce and was far enough along in that process that I knew that you can either fight about who's right or you can focus on what's important. And, you know, in the case of the divorce, it is the kid's well-being. And in the case of teaching, it's like, am I getting to teach or not?
Right.
So I have no idea how that decision was made or if people even realized that it was a decision. But
I suspect there were attorneys involved, just, you know.
Well, there certainly were before I came back, because we had to negotiate the most important... Actually, I'm saying this as though it's funny, but for trans people, it's one of the most difficult issues in the workplace is what bathroom would I use? So I think I may also be the only professor in history who has sat in a room with a dean and four attorneys, or was it only three attorneys, discussing my bathroom usage.
I have to ask, what did they do? What did they decide?
Well, the yeshiva had hired a firm.
By the way, that's the first time I've ever asked that question. So, in 10 years of doing this show.
So the attorney for yeshiva, who was a lesbian, said to my attorneys, who were gay men, as you know, no court has ever supported a trans person's right to use the bathroom of their gender in the workplace. You will lose on this one, so why don't you just give it up right now? And so the stipulation was that I would only use unisex, you know, single stall restrooms. And that was a condition of my return to yeshiva.
I think everybody just learned something new here. Discovering that you were in the wrong body, and tell me if that's the wrong way to think about it. Discovering
works for me.
Okay. How long a process was that for you?
So again, different. I just want to give a sort of a little explanation of terms here, because most people don't know how to talk about this, and the terminology is it's pretty new and keeps changing. I don't get the memos all the time of what the latest terms, but there's now an umbrella term, transgender, that refers to all kinds of people whose gender is more complicated than I'm a man or I'm a woman. If you need to say more than that, you're transgender in some way or another.
Sure.
A small part of those people are transsexuals, who are people whose discomfort with living as the gender that they're assigned at birth is so great that we need to sort of change ourselves and our lives and our bodies just in order to feel that we're living authentic lives. So I'm a transsexual, and among transsexuals, again, we're all different folks and we have different stories, but I became aware that there was a problem actually in preschool, and it wasn't a problem with my body, it was a social problem. So I'd been hanging out with my mother being bored for a couple of years. And finally I get to preschool. Great, I have kids to play with. And I went to play with my natural peer group, which to me was the girls. And it wasn't a conscious thing. And they ran away, giggling. And I'm like, okay, what's wrong with them? So I went again, and they ran away and giggled again. And I thought, okay, if I want to play with them, I have to play some sort of weird chase game. So what is it? And gradually I realized that they were seeing me as something different than they were. I was a boy, and if I wanted to be anywhere in their vicinity, I must want to kiss them. Now, you know, in some ways, I was a typical boy in the sense that, you know, kissing to me was just what your mother did when it was bedtime. So I thought, you know, they think I'm trying to tuck them in at night. Like, what are they talking about here? But by the time I was in first grade, I realized that my sense of who I was completely different than how I was being seen. And I was aware enough of my own body to realize that I didn't feel at home in it. I had to learn how to pretend to be a boy. And I would take notes, and I would criticize myself at the end, because a lot of what boys did didn't make much sense to me, and I was terrified that I would be discovered. At the same time, I was young enough that I thought, this could change. And a lot of trans kids are like that. And so most trans kids that I've ever heard of are extremely religious in a very direct way. We talk to God because God is the only person who knows who we are. And God is the person who made us who we are. And God is the only person who can make us who we need to be. And it's weird because whenever I've compared my conversations with God when I was a small child with other trans peoples, they're the same.
Wow. No matter what their religious background?
That's right. We offer to hurt ourselves or give everything up or anything if God would just, you know, fix us and enable us to have the bodies that we're supposed to have.
When did you decide that you needed to do something biological, that you needed to make the change?
So when I was growing up, at first I thought I was the only creature of my kind, and I wasn't at all sure that I was a human being. But in one of my mother's women's magazines, when I was 8 or 9, there was an article by a mother talking about her child's what we would now call transition from male to female, and I was like, oh, there are other people, and we're called transsexuals. And, you know, I was a future English professor, so I loved that that was such a long word. I was something with a long word. And there was a way that I could actually become myself. So I grew up kind of expecting to do that at some point, but I also grew up making the choice, believing that if I told people who I really was, I would become unlovable. And so every day, that was the way that I lived, as though I were in a world, which is pretty much true, and it's still pretty much true, in a world where the truth about me would make me seem like a monster. So even as I became an adult, I felt that there, and I could have done something about it, I felt like I had a choice between being loved and being myself. And I wanted to be loved.
It's a fantastic story. The book is called Through the Door of Life, A Jewish Journey Between Genders, which has resulted in you really embracing life. I want to thank Dr. Joy Layden for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I encourage you to get the book. It's really an amazing story, and she's teaching at Yeshiva University right now. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Please join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guests will be Miriam Hawley and Jeffrey McIntyre, the co-author of Our Bodies Ourselves, and her husband, talking about sacred marriage and business partnership. Our playout this morning comes from the CD The Spirit of World Jewish Music and Chazan Alberto Mizrahi. It's a Sephardic version of the Shabbat table song Tzur Mishelo. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Tzur mishelo achalno, tzur mishelo.